Chapter 33. Most of the lights in the mall were out, with the rest starting to dim. Even the background music was offline. Bishop looked down the length of the concourse while he adjusted his eyesight and fine-tuned his hearing. That he'd managed to get this far without running into any aliens was almost enough to make him reconsider the idea that luck was real. On the other hand, if it were, his had just run out. The freight elevator he needed was at the other end of the mall, and the movement he could detect between the lift and his current location didn't belong to humans. His cheap polycarbon knees weren't up to the stress of crawling through the air ducts under the floor or in the walls. Running was also out of the question. There was no give to this surface. It was either a brisk walk or levitation, and the latter wasn't one of his factory-installed features. The artificial waterfall just up ahead was now surrounded by a lake about 7.5 centimeters deep. If the drain were blocked, it should have shut down before overflowing. He reached it and was surprised to see a little water still trickling down the ersatz rock formation despite the body floating face down in the pool. Under the circumstances, his core programming didn't command him to investigate or identify the deceased, but it did log the corpse as another failure within the grid of his responsibilities. He'd racked up a lot of those lately. The official count included the entire colony of LV-426, which just by itself exceeded the total of all his previous failures combined. A human doing the accounting might have excluded them since almost all the colonists had died while the Marines were still in transit, but artificial persons were programmed to a different standard that called for complete and utter service. The human architects behind artificial intelligence had done this to prevent the emergence of a rogue, megalomaniac AI hell-bent on enslaving or wiping out Homo sapiens. Even centuries after the dawn of AI development, the nightmare of a robot uprising refused to die. Humans had been so worried about their intelligent machines turning against them, they hadn't given as much consideration to the nightmares that might be waiting as they spread throughout the galaxy. Well, except to bring weapons. In case of hostilities. Weapons had always worked before, as long as there were enough of them, although even just one weapon was better than nothing, which was, at the moment, what Bishop had. Not that he'd have taken one, even if Hicks had offered. The group needed weapons more than he did. After he had set the fusion package to self-destruct, maybe he could look for something. Once he was through the impromptu lagoon, Bishop took a moment to shake water from his boots. He didn't see any more water hazards ahead, just plenty of broken glass and other detritus scattered over the floor from the various shops where creatures had smashed their way in or out. Several meters farther on, he stopped again in front of a place where a sphere covered in a mosaic of tiny mirrors lay among dismembered mannequin parts and glass from the smashed display window. It was listed in his database as catering to nostalgia fantasies. How humans could be nostalgic for times they'd never experienced seemed improbable to Bishop, but humanity was an improbable species. The crunch of broken glass under heavy steps made him freeze in place. It was coming from the wreckage of a sports bar. Bishop's database said it had been well-stocked with a wide variety of potables while the sports part had been more of an afterthought. It ran one recording of one soccer game continuously on the rear wall screen. The shifting light told him it was running even now. He moved toward it for a closer look, staying behind one of the few bits of the facade that was still standing, just as a large blob of black sludge hit the wall screen with a wet smack. It stuck there for a second, before an inhuman hand with long talons started spreading it around as it slowly began to harden, acquiring a pearlescent sheen. There were four of the creatures in the bar, the last one emerging from the large, ragged gap where acid blood had eaten away part of the floor. They were of the older generation, the ones that cocooned their victims. One had just finished wrapping up an unconscious older man Bishop recognized as Werner Schumann. He'd left op saying he was going to try contacting the diplomatic network from his office and hadn't made it. No one, including Bishop, had thought he would. The alien mashed Schumann's cocoon roughly against the screen, pushing it upward until the back of his drooping head touched the ceiling, then stood back and hissed loudly at the man. It made Bishop think of big game hunters from a less enlightened age, hanging animal heads on the wall as brutal trophies. This species took brutality to a much higher level. The alien bent to take a fistful of black sludge from a pool on the floor and added more layers to the cocoon, careful to leave Schumann's chest clear. It paused every few seconds to thrust its eyeless face close to Schumann's and hiss, spraying him with thick saliva. Schumann remained unresponsive. Either he had nerves of steel, or he was comatose and all but dead. Bishop hoped it was the latter. The other three aliens were busy cocooning other unconscious victims, one using the sludge on the floor, the other two extruding the same material from under armored plates in their torsos. Producing sludge from their bodies was something Bishop hadn't seen before. He added it to his store of existing data, careful to get every detail. He was still watching when it occurred to him that he had been so focused on the activity in front of him that he had failed to register the subtle ambient changes in his surroundings. His left knee signaled strain as he straightened up from his hunched-over position and turned around. The enormous queen had undergone some mutations. The framework around its head was larger and more elaborate, and a sort of coxcomb with razor-sharp edges ran the length of its elongated skull, although the head itself was noticeably smaller and still eyeless. Its perception, however, was undiminished, although at the same time he had the impression it didn't know what to make of him. Thick saliva dripped from its jaws as its head tilted from one side to the other. Given the circumstances, Bishop was certain it had never encountered an artificial person before. He was also certain that whatever it decided to do next wasn't going to end well for him. The last queen he'd met hadn't liked him much either. Then, from the bar, he heard bones cracking and flesh ripping and a choked cry of pain as an alien emerged from one of the cocooned humans. The queen looked up to see what all the fuss was about, and Bishop didn't hesitate. He dashed for the freight elevator and found it waiting with its doors open. The queen let out an infuriated scream. Leaping into the elevator, he grabbed the strap dangling from the upper door while he was still airborne and yanked it hard as he landed, shutting both doors barely a half a second before the queen rammed into them. The impact shook the car and made Bishop's knees wobble. The queen continued to scream and throw itself against the elevator until the top door bent inward, making a gap wide enough to thrust its tail through. Bishop squeezed into the corner by the control panel, barely out of reach as it whipped from side to side and hit the down button. The machinery growled, and the queen answered it with an even louder scream Bishop felt clear through his skeleton, both original and cheap polycarbon. The car shuddered, sank a few meters, and stopped. Bishop hit the down button again. Metal scraped and squealed as the motor strained and then quit with a very final thunk. The tail withdrew, and the enraged queen tried to shove its head through the gap, but it was too small. It pulled at the lower door in an effort to widen the opening. The metal bent a little, just enough to keep the elevator jammed in the shaft. Bishop flattened himself on the floor and felt around carefully. What he wanted would be near the center of the car, although the schematic in his database wasn't quite to scale. There it was. Hicks wasn't there to smile, so Bishop did it in his place as he started prying up tiles. The burning smell was pretty strong by the time Martinez and Hicks got the group to the Blue Concourse entrance. Jackson unlocked the hatch with her ID and was about to step through it when Martinez pulled her back and went in ahead of her. Jackson's light pen drew momentary zigzags in the air as she shifted impatiently from one foot to the other, waiting for Martinez to signal it was safe to go through. Hicks stood guard as Rossetti followed Jackson. Spence had to help Halliday to keep her from tripping. She was getting worse, and so was the air. If both continued to deteriorate, the group would have to make some hard decisions. Or rather, he would. It should have been Rossetti's call, Rossetti's burden. But it was clear to Hicks that the group didn't trust the colonel enough to take orders from him. Part of that was due to the bad feeling Jackson had fomented, although in Hicks's view, Rossetti was more to blame than she was. Jackson was only a civilian. Rossetti had let his peacetime desk job turn him into a hothouse flower. He was no better than Gorman, who hadn't stepped up until the whole squad had been wiped out. This was worse than LV-426, not just because there were more monsters and more civilians, but because he didn't have Ripley and Newt to help him out. At least he had Bishop. And if they came out of this alive, they would have him to thank. And if they didn't live through it, at least they'd be taking the goddamn aliens with them. Assuming Bishop made it to the fusion package, that was. He would. He had to. The alternative was unthinkable. A distant crash followed by an inhuman shriek jarred Hicks out of his thoughts. Quill had frozen halfway through the hatch with Talisa's hand on their shoulder. Both looked terrified. Hicks gave both of them a rough push to get them going again and signaled Martinez to pick up the pace. There was another long, high-pitched cry, brutal and full of rage. Hicks patted himself down, found the chunk of plastique he wanted in his top right vest pocket, and stuck it in the center of the door. When he was sure it would stay put, he wedged a time-delay grenade into the center of the explosive, molding it like clay to make sure it held fast. Time-delay grenades had improved in the last 4 years. This one was more compact, yet more powerful, and the maximum delay was 2 minutes, twice as long as before. Judging by the shriek he'd just heard, he thought 90 seconds would do it. He stepped through the hatch, pulled it closed, and locked it, then ran to catch up with the group. Jackson had taken his place at the rear. As soon as she heard his footsteps, she whirled, aiming his own service weapon at him. "Easy there, Tiger," Hicks gestured for her to keep moving. None of them were especially athletic, but he was pretty sure they could manage a 150-yard dash in a minute and a half. "Where were you?" Jackson demanded. The explosion answered for him. The group was well out of range, but the blast was powerful enough to shake the deck. Vito lost his balance and fell over, mostly from surprise. Hicks yanked him back up on his feet and pushed him forward, making him turn around when he tried to look back.
"What was that?"
Vito asked, wide-eyed with fear.
"Tell you later,"
Hicks said as he got them going again. There was a lot of damage in this section. Small vehicles, scooters, and two-seaters had skidded out of control to collide with each other or crash into the tunnel walls, leaving wreckage, torn-up rags that had once been clothing, and plenty of blood. Some dry, some less so, as well as fragments of bone and flesh. The odor of decomposition mingled with the smell of smoke. It wasn't an improvement. He and Martinez did their best to move them along too quickly to get a close look at anything especially ghastly, in spite of the worsening air quality. What they needed, Hicks thought, was a transport like the six-wheeler he'd had to abandon. It would be easier on them if they didn't have to plod past the remains of what might have been their co-workers. If someone recognized a rag as a friend's shirt, or worse, a tattoo on a patch of skin. Hicks killed that line of thought and focused on the group's condition as a whole. Despite her youth and inexperience, Martinez was a damned good Marine, and she had a great poker face. But Rossetti should have retired years ago, taken up residence in some Veterans Administration outpost, or even gone back to Earth to spend his days trading exaggerations with other war horses. Spence was all right for the time being, mostly because she'd been tending to Halliday, trying to keep her too distracted to fall apart again. Hicks knew she blamed herself for poor old Tully Charles A., and she was trying to make up for it by saving someone else. He'd known plenty of other people like her. They were called Mom, or Sarge, or even C.O., Rossetti being a particularly glaring exception.
"Big talk for a guy whose life is repeating on him like bad chili."
In his mind, a Pone blew cigar smoke at him, then vanished. Jackson, chief of ops. He could probably depend on her to dig deep and come through without losing her shit. Although, he'd never imagined working with anyone named Mandala. Unless he was way off about how old she was, her parents would have been the right age for the last resurgence of hippie culture. She probably had siblings or cousins named Steel Pike or Frodo or Star Song. The others...
"Come on, Hicks! What was that? Really?"
Jackson had materialized on his left.
Damn it, she just wasn't going to leave it alone.
"Some of those things are following us," Hicks told her in a low voice. "I left them something to slow them down."
"Fine with me," she said. "Just don't blow up another air scrubber, or worse, blast a hole in the outer hull."
Hicks nodded, then saw that Vito and Abelera had slowed down, obviously wanting to listen in.
"Hey, I didn't say rest," he said loudly. "Get the lead out. Andale, vite, vite, bistro."
"There's a bistro? Where?" Vito said, looking around.
"Just move it already," Jackson gave him and Abelera a push.
"And in case you don't know, that's not London fog, it's smoke. So either haul ass or lay down and die."
In spite of everything, Hicks allowed himself a momentary grin. If he couldn't get these people to safety with Jackson and Martinez helping him, he probably wouldn't make it himself.